I got out and didn't have to carry anything because I didn't have anything. And I headed for some trees because I'd seen a little dirt road on the other side. And I went into the trees and I was wondering, you know, what if I could was heading in the right direction. And all of a sudden, pitchforks came at me from every direction. And they were all Dutchmen who had seen me land in the German airplane with swastikas on it. And they hated the Germans like you couldn't believe. And boy, they had pitchforks. And I put my hands up and kept pointing like that and yelling, "American, American." Nobody could understand me. And we got on the other side of the trees, and I was still had my hands up, and there was some dirt road there. And as the good Lord helped out, a truck from a British truck came by, and it had two men in it, and I was still holding my hands up, and I was waving them like that, and the vehicle stopped, and I said, "I hope you can help me. I'm a Yank, and they think I'm a Kraut because I just left a German airplane over there in that field on the other side of the trees." They say, "I see, old chap, pop in." Anyway, that's not a horror story. It's a stupid story. And for a year and a half, or maybe 2 years, I wouldn't tell that story to anybody in the world. I was so embarrassed and felt so stupid about it. But all of a sudden, everybody tried to act like I'd done something great. I didn't do anything great. I did something very stupid. But my friend came to an air show, and he had read about it in the paper, and some one of the little people that keeps people out of the crowd away from the airfield came over, and he said, "Mr. Hoover, there's a man over there that said he was in prison camp with you." And my narrator, who flew one of my airplanes from one place to the other, he said, "God, Bob, there must have been 100,000 people in that prison camp. Every time we go to any air show, somebody comes out and says he was there." And I said, "Well, they started out with 1,000 and ended up with 10,000 prisoners. And I got to be known by a lot of people." But he said, "It looks like to me you must have been with 10,000 of people." That wasn't the case. But they wanted to interview him. And before I could shut him up, he started telling the story. And suddenly my embarrassment was coming out in front of the whole world. It's been there ever since. And I was no hero. I didn't do anything but be stupid. That's all there is to it.
Bob, P-47, this airplane behind you. Any memories of the P-47?
I've got some wonderful things to tell you. When I was one of those chosen to be the test pilot, the number one test pilot on the Bell X-1 first rocket ship, and my friend Chuck Yeager was a maintenance officer in the flight test, but he had not been through any of the test pilot schools, and had the assignment, and this is kind of interesting, I think, seriously interesting. We were flying P-80s, and I was testing an airplane that was in the research stage, and we had three of us on the thing, and we were now working towards breaking the sound barrier. Now, most people said, "What in the world is the sound barrier?" Well, it is a point, and it's a very technical thing, but I'm going to make it simple. Where the wings are attached to the fuselage on an airplane, when you get past 500 miles an hour, which is about 8/10 of a Mach number. Mach number 1 is speed of sound. That's what we couldn't achieve, and we tried it. I flew P-40s and flew P-51s first, and I got the P-51 up to about, a little over 8/10, which is 500 miles an hour, starting out as high as you could climb, about 45,000. And with the P-47, the same thing. Controls would stiffen up, and it's called hysteresis. The forces of the wind will suck your elevators up, and you have a lot of wiring, and it's stretching, and it stretches, and suddenly the airplane has no control. You're sitting there, and the stick is in concrete until you slow down. So if you got over a certain speed, you had this. So that's why they called it a sound barrier, because, and that's hysteresis, well, the stretches of the cables, and then the air can do what it wants to. And if it sucks them up, which it does, and some of the tests I did with different airplanes, it sucks them up, then the airplane pulls a P-40 or P-39 at about 400 miles an hour. You're pitched up, because I had to do it with every type of airplane. And so there was the P-47. I used all the earlier airplanes that were not fast enough, but the P-51 and the P-47, I could actually get them to 500 miles an hour. And with 500 miles an hour on this airplane, I felt better in it, but it too would be stiffened up, and you aren't going anywhere. You're going in the direction you're pointed when you get up to 500 miles an hour. And so in my test program, there were three of us working on it. And the first one, we had a motor that was driving a piece of controls that were added on the tail. We were trying to break down this turbulence of airflow that kept you from going up speed of sound. And we had an electric motor that drove a device we had put on the horizontal stabilizer back just where the elevators are at the hinge point. We put a flat plate. See, nobody knew had any research. They didn't have any research. But a flat plate about this wide that went the span from the fuselage out to the tip. And to pull that up was like putting your flaps up. And what they wanted us to do was to go out to whatever Mach number we could get. And with the P-47, I felt better in it than I did in the other airplanes. And this final day came along. First pilot was killed, and he got killed when the canopy came off when he was in a dive. And it dished into the cockpit, and we found his head and his helmet about, I'd say, 2,000 feet away from the wreckage. And there were three of us on that program, and I was the junior person, the youngest also. And the other fellow and myself said, it's far more risky than we considered it to be. And in engineering, we're trying to figure out what to do next. And I said, well, I suspect that electric motor didn't have enough power, and he couldn't get it to go to the different ratchets that you had to go to get the thing elevated to get through compressibility. And so I said, why don't you put a big motor on it? And so they put a big motor on it, and second pilot lost the canopy, and his head came off. Same thing, found the wreckage, found the head.
Did this give you pause about continuing this program?
My turn next, and I thought, I don't think I like this job. But I said, let's make that stick manual. And this is where the P-47 really comes in. I said, put a stick over here just back of the throttle quadrant that goes all the way to the floor. There's a big steel pipe like this. And put the controls, and instead of the motor, I want to physically have this go all the way up telescoping until I could get to the top of the canopy. And if you look at the canopy, you can see how the shape is high here. It goes back like this. And I had that to go all the way up, and I could reach up then. I've had my both shoulders broken, so I can't raise my arms, but I'd raise it as high as I could. And then I could pull a little thing I had, and I could make it go a notch at a time. And so I did a lot of flights before the bad one. And I'd get it going, and I thought I had it made. I was still not stuck at lower speeds. And so I kept working at it. And finally, I got to where I could pull it. My chase pilot said, "Bob, you got to pull out of that dive. I've done everything I can, and I don't know if I'm going to make it or not."